from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Coming up next on Forum, we get the latest developments on one of the most disturbing incidents that's happened in the Bay Area in recent years, the alleged brutal gang rape of a high school sophomore at Richmond High. It's a case that raises important and disquieting questions. And then in our second half hour, we'll turn our attention to another court case, the city of San Jose's decision to challenge Major League Baseball's right to determine where the Oakland A's call home. It's all ahead on Forum. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's not often we begin a Forum broadcast by saying listener discretion is advised, but this is one of those times. Our topic for the next half hour is a trial that is trying to determine what happened on homecoming night at Richmond High School 3.5 years ago. That's when a 16-year-old high school sophomore was brutally assaulted. Many participated, even more watched. That much we know. What we don't know fully yet is who was responsible. Two people have received lengthy prison terms by way of plea bargain agreements. Two more are now on trial. Joining us to talk about a trial that deals with one of the darker episodes in recent times in the Bay Area are Malaika Fraley. She covers the courts for the Contra Costa Times and the Bay Area News Group and is covering this trial. Malaika Fraley, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us, too, is Dara Cashman. She is a former deputy district attorney in Contra Costa County. She was the head of the sexual assault unit and prosecuted the case's preliminary hearings before she retired. Dara Cashman, good morning as well.
Good morning.
Thank you both for joining us. So, Malaika Fraley, let's begin by just setting the basic scene of what happened on that night 3.5 years ago. Richmond High courtyard, a young 16-year-old is encouraged to come over to this part of the high school campus. What do we know about what then took place?
We know that she left the dance and intended to call her father to pick her up, but she was flagged down by one of her classmates that she had known since the seventh grade, who invited her to come over to this courtyard where she met, she says, about 3 or 4 boys and men were there, and they started talking about music and whatnot. Most accounts are that she started drinking their brandy, which they had shoplifted from a Food Max earlier in the day, and then became incapacitated and fell down, maybe probably because she was drunk, and that the boys and men circled her, and then one of them, or maybe more, just began ripping off her clothes, and the sexual assault began.
And we know that there were many people involved. We know that she was seriously injured. Describe some of the injuries that she received.
She suffered from serious head trauma. I think there was some skull fractures, brain swelling, obviously concussion. She presented in a deep coma when she got to the hospital. She had mild hypothermia because it was a very cold night, and you know she was mostly nude when they found her, and probably nude for at least over an hour. And then she had a 0.355 blood alcohol level, which is extremely high, near fatal level. She was a 93-pound girl, about 4'11".
And there were burns as well.
Yes, there may have been burns. There was definitely abrasions, bruises all over her body. There was scrapes on top of her feet, on top of her toes. There was scrapes in all different directions on her knees and on her back, as if she was, you know, dragged back and forth and sideways.
And all of the reports have been that many participated, many more watched. How do we know that, Malaika, that many more people were standing around observing?
I think that there's lots of inconsistencies in some of the accounts by some of the boys and men who were there. But one thing that's always been the same is that there was 10, more than 20 people there at a time. Boys were going to the dance, leaving the dance, getting rejected from the dance, and kind of making their way to this courtyard. Some people weren't even passing, but they were hearing about it from other points and then coming to look to see what was happening.
And Derek Cushman, let's now talk about what the legal course has been so far. Two people have been convicted through plea bargains. We have two more on trial now. Describe the charges, because the charges involve something that's sometimes called the one-strike law in California. Describe what that is, please.
Well, there's certain sexual assault activities, where if you are convicted, it's a life sentence. It could be 15 to life or 25 to life, depending on the factors. In this particular case, the factor that causes it to be a life sentence is what we call acting in concert, which means sexually assaulting someone at the same time as someone else. So that is an aggravated crime, and the legislature's decided that's one of those situations where it deserves a life sentence.
You were the head of the sexual assault unit when you were the former deputy DA in Contra Costa County. This case is obviously so horrific in so many ways, but I'd like you to sort of put it in some perspective for us, if you can. Is it the worst case that you dealt with, or is this something that we sort of need to open our eyes to as something that is something that is more common than we would like to believe?
Well, I wouldn't call this kind of case common, but in my experience, there were other cases where there were gang rapes in concert not too long ago in Richmond. Probably about a year and a half before this case, I filed a case that involved multiple assailants and a brutal, brutal beating. The victim was kidnapped off the street, moved to various different locations, and was brutally, brutally beaten. I mean, the police followed the blood trail and could tell the various locations she'd been at. That particular case was horrific also, but it didn't get the same media attention. So sometimes it's just a question of, you know, what draws the public's attention. These kind of cases are happening. They're not common, but this certainly isn't the only case. It's not a completely unique case.
Derek Cushman, former deputy DA in Contra Costa County. Let's talk about the developments this week in the trial. There are two men who have been charged with this rape in concert charge. Marcellus Peters and Jose Montano. Testimony this week, the most compelling of which, I'm sure, Malika Fraley, was the young woman herself whose identity is being protected. What did she have to say? Characterize her testimony this week.
She took the stand on Monday. It was the first time that she had ever publicly testified in this case. She appeared nervous as she walked in. Her arms looked a little awkward, and then later she explained that she has problems with her shoulders popping in out of the socket because of this attack. She was escorted to the stand by a victim's advocate, and she sat down, and she seemed to relax after a while, and she spoke about getting ready for the dance, what she wore, going to the dance, leaving because that the music was too loud and the strobe light was bothering her. She was getting a headache. And then going to, walking outside and being invited to this courtyard. And she said that these boys and men were very polite to her. And one of them even put down his jacket onto to a bench that was moist so that she wouldn't ruin her dress. And from there, she seemed to not remember anything until she woke up into the hospital, woke up having trouble talking because she had a breathing tube taken out. And then, you know, just kind of the long-term effects of what had happened. Like I mentioned, the shoulder, also her hips have problems now. She suffers from reoccurring migraines. She has problems with concentration and memory. She said she used to be a really quick learner, and now she has really trouble concentrating.
And in terms of the memory questions in particular, Derek Cushman, what sort of challenges does this present from a legal standpoint that she doesn't remember what happened, although apparently on the night itself at the hospital, she did say something about having done some drinking, which she doesn't now recall. Does that give the defense in this case a particular opening? What are the challenges involved in dealing with that testimony?
Well, certainly a victim who remembers is going to be, you're going to be in a better position because they can explain exactly what happened. But from her personal point of view, I think it's a blessing that she doesn't remember the assault. I kind of looked at this case as if it was the same as trying a murder case where you don't have a victim. You just have to look to the physical evidence, which is the most compelling in this case. And then, of course, there's the witness testimony. That's a little more troubling in this case because of the character of the witnesses and the inconsistencies between what everybody has said. But still, I think when you put all this evidence together, the jury will be able to see a clear picture even without the victim remembering.
Let's talk some about those inconsistencies, because as you've covered the trial, Malaika Fraile, you hear different versions of this story, and everyone or many of those involved were under the influence of something or other. Is that something that seems to be playing out as a big factor in the trial, the sort of varying versions of what actually took place on that October 9th?
Oh, definitely. And the prosecutor, John Cope, he warned the jurors at the beginning of the case that people were going to be minimizing their role or their friend's role in what happened. I think that the basic picture of what happened has been consistent, but it's just been little details about when someone left, you know, when someone arrived, where this person was, where that person was. I think that at the end of the day, the jurors will know what happened.
And how will they exactly know that, though, Derek Cashman? I mean, it's obvious and undisputed that this woman was brutally assaulted. But how do you know who, and how do you know how many? I mean, is this something that can be determined factually by way of DNA evidence? How do you become more precise about that question?
Well, I mean, in this particular case, there is physical evidence in the method of DNA profiles that shows that there were multiple assailants. I mean, that's completely clear. Unfortunately, many of the DNA profiles have not been identified, so we don't know precisely who was involved. The witnesses do have self-serving interests and some wariness about the system anyway, and you know, they're not exactly embracing this prosecution, so that makes it more difficult. But I think juries are intelligent. I think they listen very carefully, and I think when they hear what everybody has to say and they put it together with the physical evidence, they will have a pretty clear idea of what happened and at least of what these two particular defendants, what their part in it is, which is really all they have to determine. They don't, you know, it would be great if we could find out who everybody involved was, but that's not their question for this particular trial.
We want to open up our conversation to those of you listening this morning as well. If you have a question about the trial, observation that you'd like to make, particularly if you live in the Richmond community, we'd welcome your thoughts and comments and questions. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can post your thoughts or concerns on our Facebook page or on our website as well. I want to ask you, Derek Cashman, about the question of force, because there's been some question about that. In other words, if this young woman were so drunk, so had such a high blood alcohol level that she was incapable of resisting in any way, is it really a question of force? In some ways, it seems like an extremely odd question, I know, but that's come up, right?
Well, there was an attempt to bring that up at the preliminary hearing, but the reality is it doesn't matter whether or not she's resisting. You don't have to resist to be raped. It's a question of whether or not force was applied in order to accomplish the act. I mean, she was beaten. She was kicked. The testimony is she was forcibly, her underwear was forcibly pulled down. I mean, that's force right there. In order to just to force somebody's underwear down is applying force. And it doesn't matter. You don't have to have tremendous amounts. The idea that she, you know, could not resist, I mean, I think that the testimony and the physical evidence shows that that's just not true.
And Malaika Fraile, what are the attorneys for Marcellus Peters and Jose Montano, the two men who are currently on trial for this rape in concert charge? Do you have some sense of what kind of defense is being offered?
Yes, for Jose Montano, there are several accounts of him actually mounting the victim. Some people say they saw him put on a condom. Some say they didn't. But they think that he raped her, you know. And his attorney has been focusing on questions on what exactly people saw. I think that she is going to be arguing that he kind of got on top of her like as a joke and never penetrated her. So her questions are all about what exactly did you see? Did you see him unzip? Did you see him expose himself? And people have kind of wavered on that. I think that most people think that he did do it, commit an act of rape, but she wants to know exactly what they saw. And then for Marcellus Peter, we haven't heard a lot of testimony about him so far. From the guys who were at the scene, it doesn't seem like anyone saw him do anything, but he has DNA evidence found in a used condom. And his attorney, in opening statements, asked the jurors to keep an open mind. He said that this was trace evidence that could have been transferred. He's been asking – yesterday he asked the crime lab technician – about contamination, about ways that DNA could be transferred from one object to another. So I think that that's where he's moving.
And what are some of the legal questions that are involved there, Derek Heshman, as far as the question has come up that it was a windy night or that the helicopter landed to transfer the victim to the hospital, that might have disturbed the crime scene? How do you sort out those sorts of questions?
Well, I think that those are the kind of questions that the defense, you know, they have to come up with something. They're trying to raise some doubt in the jury's mind. But I think ultimately, when the jury hears all of the evidence, they'll be able to decide whether or not they're legitimate. I mean, they've already heard the evidence that the helicopter landed quite some distance away and there was no wind. So, you know, the attorneys can say anything, but their statements are not evidence. I think the jury will make their decision based on the evidence, not on the statements of the attorneys.
And what's still to come, Malika Fraley, in terms of the testimony still to be heard for the remainder of this particular trial? And then we'll talk about who else will be tried in the future.
Yeah, we're nearing the end of the people who were actually in the courtyard. And I think we're moving in next to detectives, the people who interviewed all of these suspects, and then the DNA evidence and all the scientific evidence.
And Derek Heshman, there's one interesting part of this trial. These are two men being tried, and there are two juries. Tell us why that happens and what's going to happen if those juries need to hear, one jury needs to hear one bit of testimony and the other not.
Yeah, I mean, the preference is always to have one trial if you can, because for judicial economy and also to minimize the trauma to the victim. She's already been traumatized once. The fewer times she has to testify, the better. But sometimes there's specific evidence that is only admissible as to one defendant. Usually that comes in the form of a statement. So the majority of this evidence that both juries can hear because it applies to both defendants, but there will come a time when there's going to be specific evidence that is only admissible against Marcellus Peters and other evidence that's only admissible against the other defendant. So at that point, one jury will be excused and will hear the evidence that's admissible to the defendant that they'll make a decision on, and then vice versa when the other evidence comes in.
Let's spend a moment talking about what will happen following this trial. There are more people to be tried, correct, Malika Fraley?
Yes, there's two more men awaiting trial, but they are not charged with rape in concert. One is charged with rape and one is charged with, I think it's digital penetration of a minor.
And Derek Heshman, the reason why they're not being charged with rape in concert is?
Well, as to the digital penetration, I think the evidence at the preliminary hearing came out and was pretty consistent that whatever sexual act occurred between him and the victim before the mass assault. So it was not in concert in the sense that that particular defendant had supposedly left before the actual multiple assault occurred. As for the other defendant, I'm not really certain. I think what happened after I left, there was a 995 motion, which is a motion to dismiss certain charges, and the court found that there wasn't enough evidence to find that he acted in concert with the other defendants. But I'm frankly a little bit perplexed by that.
Malika Fraley, can you add to that why one of the remaining defendants is only being charged, I shouldn't say only, but is being charged with rape as opposed to this larger charge of rape in concert?
Well, I think it was because his DNA is all over everywhere. It got on other defendants. It was all over her. It was on the bottle. Excuse me. But no, there's no one, none of the witnesses that were there, of all the people that they talked to, ever placed an older man there. This was a 45-year-old black man. And there was just no corroborating evidence that, he was there. So,
but he is still being charged.
He's still charged with rape. But I think that there just wasn't enough support that to corroborate that he was part of this mass attack. It's kind of a mystery, actually.
Yeah.
We should spend our last few moments, and we apologize for not being able to take phone calls, but we're having some issues with our phone system at the moment. We'll get those taken care of as soon as we can. But let's spend our last moment or two on how this is resonating within the community and what you think, first, as a former prosecutor, Derek Cashman, we should take from this story in terms of the need to focus on these kinds of crimes.
Well, I mean, I think that we've always focused on the horrific crimes. I think what struck a chord so much in this case was the idea that so many people could watch this kind of a crime occur, not do anything about it, and not be held legally responsible. I think that's why this probably hit so many people in such a hard way, because how can somebody see this tiny little girl being brutalized and not do anything about it? I mean, the woman who finally called 911 wasn't even at the scene. She just heard about it and was horrified. So I think that's probably what strikes the chord with most of us, is the idea that people can become so uninvolved and so callous that they can watch something like this and not do anything about it.
And Malaika Fraley, as you've covered this issue and been in the community, how does that particular question continue to resonate? What sort of questions has it provoked among parents, among kids, among people at the high school?
You know, I'm not really sure about that, but I do know that I get a lot of feedback from readers and a lot of outrage, and it is a question that still comes up a lot. Like, why didn't anyone stop this? And when you hear from the people who were there, a lot of them seem to have disapproved of what was going on, but they, for whatever reason, they didn't have the courage to stop it. And now on the stand, they appear ashamed. There was a man there the other day who was, you know, it had come up that someone in his own family had been sexually assaulted before, and that, you know, he didn't condone what was going on, but at the same time, he didn't do anything to intervene. And that seems to be a reoccurring theme in this trial.
One question we should get to that just someone just tweeted in, which is whether or not there's a racial angle to this story. Is that something that's come up at all in trial, or is that something in terms of hate crime possibilities that's being covered at all?
The only time I have heard it come up was once, and it was yesterday. And that was when Ari Morales, who's been convicted in this case, was talking about how he came upon the courtyard. And he said that he had been rejected from the dance for not having a school ID, and he walked back to this basketball court, and that someone said to him, "There's a drunk white girl over there." And that's the only time, actually, that race has come up in the trial.
All right. I know you'll continue to cover it. A difficult trial, though, it is important for us to continue to pay attention to and to ask the questions that we're continuing to ask. Malaika Fraley of the Contra Costa Times and the Bay Area News Group, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Derek Cashman, former prosecutor, deputy DA at the Contra Costa County. Thanks also for adding your insights to us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.